Welcome to Schoolhouse Equity in Education. I am your host, Allison R. Brown, Executive Director of the Communities for Just Schools Fund, where we provide resources and support to community-based organizations that are working to ensure equity in their schools. Go to cjsfund.org for more information and to subscribe to our e-newsletter. If you are tweeting, follow us at Just Schools or find us on Facebook or Instagram. Today on Schoolhouse, we are talking about dress codes and how oppressive and disruptive the codes themselves can be to Black girls' education. In 2018, the National Women's Law Center published a report, Dress Coded, Black Girls, Bodies, and Bias in DC Schools. That report gained a significant amount of traction, and the NWLC followed up with a second report just released in September, Dress Coded 2, Protest, Progress, and Power in DC Schools. My guest is my dear friend, the amazing Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center based here in Washington, D.C. Hey, Fatima.
Hey, I am so glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for being here with me. So, you know, on Schoolhouse, usually we talk about issues related to education and Black and brown communities. And so we talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, and we talk about restorative justice and school push-out. And so I can imagine folks in our audience are like, dress code? What does this have to do with anything? Why is dress code in D.C. an issue for the National Women's Law Center?
Sure. Well, I should begin by saying that the problem of dress codes is a D.C. problem, but really it's a problem anywhere where brown and black girls are concentrated. D.C. in some ways is a bit of a tip of the spear. Mm-hmm. There are so many other school districts that routinely police girls' bodies, their hair, their appearance from the moment they enter school. And what we know is that that sort of body policing sometimes means that girls get pushed out of school. Mm-hmm. They get out of school suspensions. They're in school suspensions. Mm-hmm. And they're made to also feel as if they do not belong. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of those things that schools are doing reflexively without thinking about, and then adding zero tolerance consequences as a layer on top.
So why was DC important for you to highlight?
So it's important to know that the first dress-coded project was brought to you by the National Women's Law Center, but we also had co-authors who were girls in DC public schools. Mm-hmm. And we initially weren't going to write a report. We were interviewing and having focus groups with girls. And again, they were raising that they were getting in trouble at school for what they wore. Mm-hmm. Basically, they were getting in trouble for just showing up as who they were. And so this report really grew out of conversations, and we realized we had to co-lead this campaign with young people and really be led by them. We may have come up with a bunch of solutions and they had their own, which was really exciting. So in many ways, we were in DC because we were working locally with girls who were really leaders in their community. And they're the ones that drove us to focus on the dress codes.
You know, the first report, Dress Coded, is very impressive. And
thank you.
I think what's most impressive is exactly that, that it was co-authored by the girls themselves. And they talked about their experiences in the report. Both of them are full of quotes from the girls, anecdotes from the girls. Talk about why that was so important for the National Women's Law Center to really let the girls take the lead with this work.
Well, we realized early on that these were budding activists and that it was our job at the National Women's Law Center to just provide space. And so we met with them, we co-wrote with them, co-edited with them. They wrote op-eds. They did their own media appearances. They lobbied DC City Council. They met with the Department of Education. And really, it's their experience. When they were showing up at school and getting in trouble, really just for being who they were, they wanted to make sure that people understood exactly how it made them feel. And that they had ideas. They could do something different. And what we have seen is that these young girls have taken the report and the work further than we could have ever imagined. They established committees at their schools and work with parents and teachers and administrators to come up with new policies. And when schools weren't implementing the new rules, then they held protests. I mean, I love it.
It's tremendous. It is tremendous. And, you know, I got to that timeline in Dress Coded too. And I almost cried. I mean, you've seen incredible momentum. And I want to get there, but I want to quote briefly from the first report, Dress Coded. So this is an excerpt from a policy at KIPP schools. And, you know, I talk about KIPP a lot and people know that I'm... I have feelings about KIPP. So here's an excerpt from their dress code. It says, students must wear appropriately sized tan or khaki pants, shorts, or skirts. Skirts and shorts must be worn no more than 2 inches above the knee. Belts must be worn if there are belt loops on the student's pants, shorts, or skirts. The following things are prohibited: pants, shorts, or skirts that have patterns, lace, polka dots, stripes, holes, or words. Brightly colored tights, leg warmers, knee-high socks, or fishnet stockings. And the list goes on. That's just, that's an excerpt from the dress code. So what have been some of the responses from the schools
to the report? I have to say that there have been a couple of schools who have responded to their students' activism and some parent activism that has been really inspiring. In Dress Coded 2, we quoted from the principal of Deal Middle School, who really was listening thoughtfully to the student community and to the parent community. And so there, you know, there was some pressure, but she was listening and really trying to explain to other leaders that she didn't know that the way that students were experiencing these rules. And so they've started to think about their rules as really the only rules we need are about safety. Why do you have to measure 2 inches or 3 inches of somebody's skirt? Or why do you have to always wear a belt? And one of the things that Black girls were saying, and even non-Black girls were saying about the Black girls, was that we feel really uncomfortable the way that they're going after bodies and forcing them into stereotypes about what it means to show up the same. And none of it had anything to do with learning. In fact, the lesson that they learned is that there should be a hyper-focus on their bodies. So that's the wrong lesson. In Dress Coded 2, you'll see we look at both public schools, traditional DCPS public schools, but we also on purpose looked at charter schools. And one of the things that we found is that across charter schools and public schools, there are very detailed and, in our view, unnecessary dress codes. The charter schools, some of them went to a whole nother level with the level of detail, with the measuring inches, with the focus on cleavage lines. You really have to think about what is the message we are sending to young people when they enter school. Who matters? Who doesn't? Who's considered a distraction and who's valued?
That was a very interesting distinction that is drawn by the co-authors in Dress Coded 2 between the public charter schools the traditional public schools and the data. I mean, it's research, it's data to demonstrate that the charter schools on average have an F grade in terms of their restrictive dress codes.
That's right. That's right. We did grade.
Yes. And the and the traditional public schools have an average of a C.
Right. Which isn't great.
Right.
But it's something to work with.
Right.
And F worries us.
Yes.
Right.
And what do you attribute that difference?
Well, one of the things that is deeply worrisome is that charter schools might use the format of a charter to say, well, we want to do an individual thing.
Right.
And if that individual thing just so happens to perpetuate race and sex bias, I don't know. We shouldn't have to go and deal with each of these schools individually, to have the giant changes. There are some rules in there that on their face are not only steeped in race and sex stereotypes, they just don't make any sense.
Yeah.
Right? So what you would really like to see happen is for the schools to come together that no matter where you're going to school, whether it's public or charter, no matter the ward, that you are able to have the experience of going to school without the policing of your body. That seems like a baseline thing that should be happening.
Yes. Yes. So you talked about kind of some of the codes on their face are really problematic.
Yeah.
And then in enforcement, differences that you really kind of talk about it in dress coded too. And some of those differences are racial differences. Some of those are gender differences. Can you share a little bit about the differences you
saw? I mean, we were just as worried about the schools that had the really detailed, where you could easily violate it, and the ones that were just vague enough to allow disparate types of enforcement.
Yeah.
So that for some girls, you could easily get caught up and all of a sudden you found yourself in detention or in an in-school or out-of-school suspension and you just thought you were going to school. One of the things that DC did was it passed a law and said that you cannot have out-of-school suspensions for things like dress code violations, but that doesn't go into effect until next school year.
Oh, I see.
And so between now and then, students are getting inconsistent messages at the school level.
Yeah.
There's some schools, I think, that are working and planning to get ready for that moment, and others that have gripped with a tighter hold to these traditions. And so the girls that we met with and interviewed and who have been our co-authors and conspirators in this work have said, well, you know, I will wear a skirt and somebody else will wear a skirt and the skirt will look different on me.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I find myself in trouble and the other person not in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing about head wraps, which are potentially cultural expressions, in some cases religious expressions.
Yes.
Yet schools have rules banning any sort of wraps at all on your hair.
Right.
So, you know, you've
with
seen
no exception
with no exceptions just
for cultural or religious expression.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And so, that is telling Black girls in particular that they and their culture are less important.
Yeah.
And even if it wasn't a cultural expression, this again has nothing to do with your ability to learn and everything to do with race and sex stereotypes about who is and isn't a presentable person at school.
So what is some of the reasoning? I've heard some of the keywords are safety, healthy environment, focus. It's cheaper for families. What is some of the reasoning that you've encountered and what do you say to those things?
We've encountered a range. And I will just add a sort of catch-all of respectability that's in there. That we want our students to look respectful. And I don't want to diminish the root of that, right? If we think about within the Black community, there's a long tradition of having to work twice as hard, be super presentable to sort of a white norm, and even then not getting the success you want. So I understand what's at the root of some of that. And still, we are doing our students a disservice if we are not listening to them when they say, this is how I feel when you police my body in this way.
Yes.
You know, we have heard some schools talk about safety. And if safety is the guiding factor, that's a good time to sit and work with your students on what it is that makes them feel safe and what it is that makes them feel unsafe. They're very eager to have that conversation, in fact.
Yes.
They want to feel
safe.
They
want to be safe.
That's cool.
Imagine.
You know, and parents too, that have a safety conversation and maybe have that safety conversation go beyond what kids are wearing. That might help.
Right.
And, you know, some of the rules are so broad, you know. A lot of schools say you can't have a coat at all. And then at the same time, they have buildings that are cold.
And it gets cold.
And it gets cold.
In D.C.
So that can't be the solution, that you have kids who are cold.
That's not even common sense.
So we try to get at some of the things that schools have said. Mm-hmm. And we've been really pleased that some of the school leaders that have managed through a different process have been able to say, okay, well,
a different process that includes girls?
A different process that includes girls in the decision making. Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
Wow. Yes. So I want to read another quote, and this one is from Dress Coded 2. Data shows that the racial makeup of the student body correlates with the strictness of high school dress codes. Specifically, high schools that are majority Black, i.e. schools where Black students make up at least 51% of students enrolled, on average, have more dress code restrictions than other high schools. This racial trend holds even for selective high schools.
That's true.
And then a little further on the page, however, a review of 2018-2019 school handbooks shows that schools' policies are more likely to condone exclusionary discipline, meaning suspensions, expulsions, for dress code infractions than they are to condemn it. Only one high school, Anacostia High School, explicitly states that being out of dress code will not result in lost classroom time. So, will you share some of the harsh and illegal punishments that the girls talked about in Dress Coded?
I mean, some of it is just being suspended. So, being told that you cannot come back. So, you not only have to leave right away, but you cannot come back to school as an extra punishment. Some of it is in-school suspension. So, you get to stay, but you aren't able to participate in your classes. So, you lose learning time.
Right.
One
for
of the
clothes that you're wearing.
For the clothes, for what you wore to school.
Right.
One of the other things is having your parents come bring you new clothes, which, you know, school leaders might think that's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
But if you are a parent who has to take time off of work to go bring your child new clothes, that is a giant deal.
Yes.
That might not be time that you have to take. You might not be able to take the leave.
Mm-hmm.
You may get docked pay.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to be on multiple buses in order to bring new clothes to school. And so, again...
And it's mortifying for the child.
It is. And that's part of the strategy, right? The strategy is to embarrass you so much that you don't do it again, that you don't step out or over the dress code line. For some of the students, they thought they were in compliance with the dress code, and then it turned out what they wore actually didn't comply because it was either so detailed they missed Rule 20, or it was so vague they were told they didn't fit.
So I want to talk about this timeline. So this timeline in Dress Coded 2. So April 2018 is when the first report came out, Dress Coded 1.
Yes.
And since that time, there has been tremendous momentum.
There has been,
Will you share some of what has happened since?
So some of my favorite things, you know, there's been actual policy change, right? The D.C. Council did change their law. And, you know, as we told the girls.
I want to.
It doesn't happen often, Alice.
Will you say
you know
that again?
This.
This was a little more than a year ago that your report came out, co-authored by girls.
Yes, in D.C. who lobbied D.C. council members themselves.
And there has been a change in the law.
There has been a change in the law. They got the D.C. council to make a change so that these sorts of infractions mm-hmm. cannot be used for out-of-school suspensions. Mm-hmm. So that will go into effect the next school year.
Yes.
They also got the D.C. council to introduce a resolution in the interim to encourage schools to work with their students to come up with new policies. Now, listen, I would have rather that also be a law. Yeah. It is a resolution because the answer is clear here.
Yes.
Work with your students. But in the meantime, these students have taken off.
Yes.
I mean, they have gone to their schools. They've waged protests. Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite protest was the one where all the girls wore head wraps mm-hmm. because to protest against the ban on head wraps. Mm-hmm. So they all wore head wraps.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I kind of
the head wrap clapback.
Head wrap clapback. Yes. And that's how you could tell young people are behind it. Are naming it or trying
because that's
it.
Brilliant
and it was so
would never
smart.
Have come from my generation,
right? So they have been innovating and creating, you know, one thing after another to mm-hmm. really raise the visibility.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I'm really glad you read the part of the quote around the connection between the racial demographics in the mm-hmm, school, mm-hmm. because we didn't know what we would find mm-hmm. when we first started looking at it. And at first blush, I will tell you, we thought, oh, this is a problem that crosses almost every school. We're not going to find mm-hmm. differences. But then we looked a little closer mm-hmm. and we said, wait a second. If you looked at not just, you know, are you a majority minority school mm-hmm. versus majority white school? If you looked at, are you a majority black school? Mm-hmm. What happens? Mm-hmm. And the story changed. If you had a majority of black students, the list grew. The details grew. Mm-hmm. We felt like we had to do extra policing.
It's a different system.
It is a different system. And that is even true, we found, in the selective high schools, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, we looked at the dress codes for Banneker, mm-hmm. which is one of the most selective high schools in the city.
Yes, it's the number one performing high school in D.C.
It also has a very long list.
Mm. And it is predominantly black.
It is. Mm-hmm. And we compared that to School Without Walls.
The number two school in the district.
That's right. That's right. Which has had activism from a group of girls. And it had fewer rules and less detail on those rules. Mm. And here's the thing. Mm-hmm. It goes back to that question of what is the narrative we're driving around what it means to show up as a respectful student.
Yes.
And especially right now, where there are lots of ways to sort of help young people grow and transition into being adults in ways that set them up well mm-hmm. for future careers. Mm-hmm. That's what we all want for them.
Yes.
And if we're telling them that the only way to do that mm-hmm. is to abide by this list of rules in this way and potentially get sent home from school or detention for it, we're sending the wrong message.
Yes.
We're certainly not sending the message that's being sent in, say, I don't know, Silicon Valley right now, where a lot of the wealth is concentrated in this country.
Yes. And young people can show up to work in their flip-flops and tank tops. And
it
whatnot.
Turns out they can mm-hmm. and still build all the things that we are all relying
they
on.
Can still, you mean they can still innovate in short skirts?
It turns out. It turns out.
So there is also state legislation that has come about since the report. The first report came out in April.
Well, one of the things that was exciting is we did dress coded, and then we started hearing from people in different parts of the country who were like, yeah, this is clearly a problem here too. We want to drive new ideas. We want to introduce bills. And this is happening both at a city level and in states where people are thinking about this. There's been an important focus on hair as a part of appearances, in part because, and some of these stories have been able to get more attention, but for girls and women wearing natural hair who have experienced punishments from their school and or other forms of discrimination, even if not a punishment. And so California has adopted what they call the Crown Act. There are other places that have done it. New York City is another place. In California, they expressly included schools so that it is not just workplaces. Nice. It is also schools where you can't engage in that sort of discrimination. Here's the other thing. We believe that we already have strong arguments under our existing federal laws that ban race and sex discrimination, but clearly they aren't getting through. So for the states and locals that are taking this step to be very explicit, it is important because it is also a public education moment for schools and for a community that this is not a thing you should be getting in trouble for.
So at Communities for Just Schools Fund, we have the privilege of supporting grassroots organizing all over the country focused on education justice. And so I know the value of organizing, and it's beautiful to see the organizing that happened to contribute to that incredible timeline in Dress Coded 2. But I want to hear your take on why. How is it that you all have been so successful, that you have so many successes already in your pocket in just the span of a year?
I would say it is a combination of girls who were dedicated and committed and clear in their purpose. They understood what they were aiming for and were far more innovative than any of the adults around them. So I do think their innovative actions have made a difference. We also had a tremendous team at the National Women's Law Center who were so deeply passionate about this project. They were passionate about it because they were following the leadership of young girls. And they were passionate about it, I think, because they were remembering the young girl in themselves. They were remembering what it was like to be in high school and middle school and told that you were in trouble just for the way you were showed up. And so that combination forged together led to a really dedicated team. And the other thing is, this is one of those things that is so clearly wrong. Every time I've had an opportunity to listen to someone who was daring to raise a defense of more and more dress codes. In the middle of their argument, I think it is 2019 and we're done here. We are done tolerating these outdated ideas about how young people should show up.
We're done here. That's a hashtag. So what are the girls recommending for solutions? How do we fix these dress codes? How do we get to a place that really embraces young people for all of themselves? In every shape, form, fashion, race, ethnicity, gender. How do we get there?
And you know what's funny is because I started out probably more radical than some of the girls about what the solution should be. And that is also helpful for me to hear. They really believe it's important to start with a community table that includes them, that includes parents, and that includes administrators and faculty, and that there's a way to co-create. And so we heard that again and again, that they believed in co-creating. And I really hope the adults in the building support that as a model, because it's also tremendous learning for them. The second thing, there, you know, there are some model policies that we have and that they've been sharing with their schools. It won't surprise you that some of the things just totally fall away. There really is no reason to ban headscarves. You know, there really is no reason to have detailed rules about girls' cleavage or how thick their tank top straps are or are not, or the inches their skirts are to their knee. You know, those types of things that are just really rooted in stereotypes and in the idea that girls are a distraction, they fall away. Mm-hmm. And then you can get to the root of a broader conversation about safety, if that really is a concern. Mm-hmm. And what drives a safety conversation? But any school that's trying to do meaningful work on safety should probably talk to their students about what makes them feel safe or unsafe in school.
I think that's a brilliant idea. You know, I have to say that both reports are also just beautiful. They are visually beautiful.
I will tell you that the first report, and, you know, the National Women's Law Center is able to take small amounts of resources and expand them deeply. And so our first report, we have a woman on our team who leads our campaigns team, who's also a photographer. And the girls came by and she photographed them in our office. So they really wanted to be photographed in clothes that they were wearing when they got in trouble. And so that image is so powerful, in part because any person who looks at that is just going to see young people.
What is
and
the
idea
here?
That we are punishing young people for being young people makes no sense.
What are we doing?
So, but that combination between the photography, and we have a really fantastic art director at the National Women's Law Center, they really came up with something beautiful. But mostly it's the girls shining through themselves, the images of them. And I really have to credit our team, a woman named Nia Evans, a woman named Adaku Anyeka Crawford, a woman named Alexander Botsky, Hillary Woodward, Beth Stover. They really came up with a vision for how to, you know, you only have a minute to capture people's attention. And we wanted to be sure that when people held this, they understood how weighty it was and that they would be drawn in. The first report was used to train principals in DC last summer. And, you know, my kid's school principal went through the training. It's good to know.
Who did the training? Who was doing the training?
DCPS did the training on the report. And so that was important. Right? Listen, I've been doing this type of work for a long time. I don't think that policy change happens very fast or that culture change happens very fast. But sometimes you pierce through. And I think we were at a moment driven by young people where they are really saying, I want to show up as who I am, and that will help me feel successful.
And not assimilate to this white ideal.
That is not going to get me where I need to go.
Yeah.
Right? So show up as who you are. Haven't we learned anything from Lizzo?
Lizzo is missing. She is a true shero. So, you know, I want to close always. I love a good story. I want to know your story. How did you get to where you are in this work?
So I was someone who thought I would be lucky and happy if I could actually be a civil rights lawyer of any sort, anywhere. And as I came along, I realized I really wanted to work on behalf of women and girls. And when a job opened as a counsel at the National Women's Law Center, I went for that job. I went for that job even when I wasn't ready to leave my last job. But I went for it because I thought I wanted to be in the middle of it. And I've been in this job for a long time, doing different things, remaking my career along the way. And it is my deep honor to be leading this organization in this moment. I became president 2 years ago, and every day I'm really grateful that I have this amazing team who's ready to change the experiences of women and girls in this country, and especially brown and black girls. I couldn't really ask for more.
Fatima Goss Graves, I am so grateful for you, and I'm so proud of you, and I love, love, love these reports, dress coded one and dress coded two. Thank you for your work on that and for the wonderful work of the girls who co-authored those reports.
That's right.
And congratulations on the tremendous momentum that you all have experienced so far. Keep going. So sadly, this is the end of our program. My guest has been Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C. If folks want to find you on social media, Fatima, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm on Twitter as F. Goss Graves. It doesn't roll off the tongue, but F. Goss Graves. You can find me there and on Instagram at Fatima Goss Graves. And you can always follow the National Women's Law Center at NWLC. So we hope you will.
Thank you so much for being here. And thank you to the show's contributors, Alexis J. Smith and Abdul Rufus. And many thanks to all of you for listening in. Remember to follow the Communities for Just Schools Fund on Twitter at Just Schools and find us on Instagram and Facebook. Sign up for the Communities for Just Schools Fund newsletter at cjsfund.org. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful week.